Welcome back to the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And as always with Scott, I am Tom Costura.
And in this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So with that, let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of October 20th, 2025. Tom, what do you got for us?
All right, kicking it off this week. I have a pretty meaty article here, so I'm sorry if I turn some brains as I go through this. But I think it's very interesting and definitely have some cool kind of novel hunts, I think, at the end of here. So we have an article from SynActive titled Link Pro, an eBPF rootkit analysis. So Link Pro is a newly disclosed sophisticated Linux rootkit that was discovered by SynActive that leverages the eBPF modules to hide malicious activity and provide a stealthy backdoor on compromised hosts. What is eBPF for those who didn't know? EBPF, which stands for Extended Berkeley Packet Filter. It's a technology that allows you to basically run sandbox programs inside the Linux kernel to extend the functionality safely and efficiently without changing kernel code or loading kernel modules. So it's a way to really embed yourself without being seen. The implant was observed as part of an AWS Kubernetes compromise and was used to persist and conceal footholds across nodes in that cloud and in the cloud environments it hit, really demonstrating that eBPF's growing capabilities of abuse, and especially to the cloud surface or cloud native context. Link Pro's architecture splits functionality across two different eBPF programs, one that's focused on concealment, so the hooking, filtering, telemetry, that piece, and another that acts as a remote activation or knock mechanism, which that knock mechanism basically is the piece that responds to crafted network packets. So because eBPF runs safely in the kernel and can inspect or filter kernel events without traditional kernel module footprint, Link Pro really gets itself hooked into these systems once it's set, really raising the bar to try to detect or challenging the defender side. So some of the technical pieces of this, so those dual eBPF modules, one of them installs hooks to hide processes, set network sockets, and hide them, as well as hide various files from any level of user enumeration. And the second one monitors that network traffic, so it can activate when that magic packet is hit. So it can turn that backdoor on when the specific crafted packet is sent in. So that giving it that quote unquote term knock, the rootkit can remain passive until that specific network trigger, kind of minimizing any type of beaconing, really kind of hide itself inside of any network traffic, reducing that detection surface like extremely. So Link Pro includes userland components, which are Golang binaries that deploy and interact with these eBPF programs to manage persistence, implement C2 features, and more. The programs perform the kernel level stealthing while userland controls are configured. And that cloud native infection I talked about, in the observed intrusion, Synactive describes the compromise involved exploiting a vulnerable Jenkins automation server instance, deploying that malicious container or Docker images and escaping container boundaries to install that rootkit on those AWS hosts. Really kind of illustrating how that CI/CD plus container workloads enable that host compromise that we're seeing a little more as the cloud is becoming a bigger attack surface. So the infection chain holds four parts, and I'll try to hit these as high level as I can, because again, this article is super deep. There is a lot there, so I definitely recommend anyone go out and burn their brains on it a little bit. So the first part is a bash script that serves as the Docker image. The Docker image's entry points, whose purpose is to basically start SSH services. The second part is an open source program called VNT that acts as a VPN and has proxy capabilities, giving the threat actor flexibility to basically connect to the compromised host from any IP, and even use that host as a proxy to other machines. Then you have the developed, the developed piece that's a Rust downloader tagged VGET, which generates a symlink to /dev/null before downloading the V shell payload. So VShell initializes an environment variable of hist file against that symlink. So when opening a terminal, it makes sure it doesn't write any of the commands to the history log, giving it a bit of obfuscation while it's doing its thing. So the LinkPro rootkit, which is the meat of this, is the eBPF modules that I previously mentioned in the core of the attack. While there is quite a bit of depth again from this article, I'm going to focus on just a few of the specific points and some of the interesting ideas I came up or I seen or I thought of from a threat hunting perspective. So that rootkit leverages a couple BPF tools, so BPF trace and BPF tool, which are leveraged to create the backdoor's various hooks. These hooks are placed at the entry and exit of the sysBPF system call to allow it to hide its maps and programs as it's setting itself in this area, really rooting itself in that kernel sandbox. So BPF trace, which is a high-level tracing language for Linux that uses eBPF to enable dynamic tracing of kernel and user space events, really for performance analysis and debugging. This is leveraged to place the various sys calls and implement that first set of hooks. BPF tool is a core Linux utility for inspecting, debugging, and managing eBPF programs, maps, and links by interacting with that BPF file system and that BPF kernel interface. So the second layer of the kit specifically manipulates, or the module specifically manipulates it to hide itself from that tooling by leveraging a hide module. This is just adding in, as it's setting its calls in the command line, dash eBPF with the number one, which is basically, it allows itself to be hidden whenever the BPF tool is used to query those BPF settings, libraries, or what's been established in that BPF area. So with that being said, there are a few hunts that I kind of thought through here that, you know, testing in the lab, playing with a little bit. So there's some things that you can actually look for, even though this does do a lot of stealthy things, and it does kind of paint itself as really hard to detect because it establishes in that kernel sandbox. So the BPF side is really where you can put some focus. Typically, when you see that BPF trace tool being used, it's generally going to carry itself as a parent process. Occasionally, depending on the administration use, you might see it leverage, you might see it being spawned with a parent of sh bash dash, I think zsh as well, but that is still rare. Anything outside of that is definitely worth checking out. That's a good indicator that it's doing something it's not supposed to do. Another look to see around that BPF trace tool is you can kind of look for things where that process is their process path contained in that BPF trace. But you see command line associations that talk through some of the various things that it's doing. So things like looking for SSH, looking for the trace point sys calls to the specific items that are mentioned in the article, looking for anything around etc shadow, password or pseudos, unprobe, function handle capabilities, unsafe mode system or kprobe. These are things that are mentioned in the article, but they're high indicators that BPF trace is being used in a malicious form. And they are things that are typically, you know, caught by, you know, logging inside of Linux, whether through audit D, sysmon for Linux as a few. Another thing to consider or look at is the hidden module piece that I mentioned. This one's pretty low hanging fruit. Is you're looking for that dash eBPF kind of flag inside of a command line issue. And this, it if you see that eBPF with a one next to it, it's absolutely trying to hide itself. So this is not typical administration use. There are some programs that may use this to try to kind of like hide some of the weight or the noise as part of its natural programmatic mode, but it's very rare and you shouldn't see it very often. So when you see this one is an easy red flag to say, hey, we got something going on. A couple additional things that are pulled out of here too, past the BPF stuff, is they mounted the root partition with read and write permissions by executing the command mount -0 remount comma RW to root. So this is something that we've seen, and this is a hunt we've mentioned before. Definitely something to keep an eye out for. Time stomping items like the systemd resolve LD service or the ETC password file. These are things that we're seeing that occurred, as well as a creation of additional modules in the form of files that sit within the sys/fs/bpf directory. Now, this one's a touch tricky because this one doesn't natively log through any standard logging configuration. So it's something you'd have to set your audit D or your sysmon for Linux to specifically track or look at. But Scott, I said a whole lot there, and there was a lot of new terminology. I kind of love digging into this one, man. The BPF stuff was very interesting. There was I knew kind of what BPF was. I never really thought about the ways that it can be leveraged. And as I started digging, BPF has been leveraged in different ways in previous attacks over the last couple of years. So it seems like this might be a growing area to consider as a foothold point or a place to establish rootkits, specifically just because of how it functions. It makes it so easy to hide, and it seems relatively easy to deploy, but it does leave some breadcrumbs for you to follow and see what is happening in this area. When we pair that with the idea of the kind of growing trend to attack cloud surfaces, I just think it's interesting. This is one that, you know, people should definitely take a look at, consider. Obviously, look for anything I'm not mentioning. I centered in on that BPF piece because I thought that was really interesting, but I'll take a breath, Scott, and see what you thought of this one.
Yeah, so I think what is really cool that you can see from this is, if you're not familiar with the Linux operating system, it is such a file-based operating system, meaning everything that exists live that you normally wouldn't think would be a file is represented by a file somewhere. Like a good example, you know, when they referenced, you know, how they used SS instead of NetStat for like looking at what ports are open and things like that, or monitoring ports. There is a file every time a process opens a port that gets basically created to represent that port that's open during that use. Like, that's what I mean by like everything is file based. So ironically, if you know what to monitor from a file perspective, you could see a lot of activity that you wouldn't normally consider activity, right? Because usually files you think of as like static or stagnant. So this is a really good job as you just kind of try to digest everything. You kind of start to see that to some level because of everything they reference and the purpose. It's like, hey, there's this file here, but it's really representing this. There's this file here, but it really represents this. So I thought that was kind of cool. Obviously the use of Docker, to basically pull in an image and then just mount the root through like the way the Docker, compose or the Docker image, you know, it's mounting it into the Docker, so now it can reach out, because Docker is one of those things, if you don't configure it to have access to either network specific things, file specific things, and sometimes kernel specific things, it is truly just a container that is just contained within itself, and it's just interesting to see. I don't know how you would necessarily see that or what that would look like from the different telemetries, but that is also interesting. Just that's how they were basically able to get that foothold after they were able to gain that initial access from the vulnerability of the Jenkins stuff. The other thing I was thinking about, and I was trying to do some quick research while you're talking, so I'm not sure on this one. But, you know, you create symlinks from the command line a lot of times from the terminal in Linux. And I don't know if that's a binary you run to do that. Looking at their code, I mean, obviously you're kind of looking at some of the bash scripts. So, you know, it looks like they're doing kind of like your system-based calls or function calls in there. So I'm not sure if that executes independent or not, if it's the capability of bash. But the reason why I bring that up is, if there is a way to see when symlinks are being created, there's a binary for it. Any symlink that's going to point one to a null type directory or null somewhere is interesting, because you're basically syncing something, which is a good way to kind of destroy tracks. I wouldn't say that would be typically common. And then also symlinks, it may be more common, but to hidden directories. This the thing about Linux is if you ever start a file name with the dot or the period, it makes that file hidden. And so typically when you list directories in Linux, you type ls and you won't see it unless you do a bunch of additional arguments. I usually call it lather la tr, I think, or something like that. I'm blanking on how I have to like type it for me to remember it. But I usually do the thing all the time to see what's there, and I show hidden things that way. But I bring up the hidden thing too, because they did talk later on about it's kind of hard to see the execution and what's going on, but if you paid attention to if it had that specific path in the command line, which was, I think, the dot temp squiggly data, right? If it mentions that, you know, contains that keyword. I think it's also more interesting to look at if you have a lot of execution, especially from potentially the same or repeatedly the same things that contain hidden directories in the command line, might be worth looking at. I mean, one, if it's normal operation for something, you'll know it and it's easy to basically exclude. But just like, people usually don't hide activity unless they're basically trying to prevent someone from understanding how their stuff works, which most people don't really care internally. Maybe products, you know, or services you pay for, they may care. So they might run things that way. Like I said, easy exclusions, or people really trying to hide activity that might be nefarious. So I thought that was also really something to pay attention to. And I'm trying to remember, even from the Linux sysmon, I can't remember if I have ever created the rule, but if you could create a rule where you could just basically say log any kind of hidden directories, and then you can look for that, or not directories. I mean, it can be directories, but also files, anything with a preceding dot at the beginning, you can regex that pretty easily. It's just good to know when you see that kind of stuff. There are common things, like there's, you know, they even mentioned the history file. I mean, that's a hidden file that stores your bash history and things. But yeah, I think the biggest takeaway from this was it really does almost pull apart all these things of the kernel and all these things that happen behind the scenes in Linux that a lot of people don't really see, or if they did, they would have no idea why they exist. And I think this is a great entry point, because if you start like researching just some of the common names and locations, and like, well, what's this directory used for? What are these file types used for? What is this service that's being leveraged? I think you would learn a lot more about Linux that a lot of people don't talk about, but would also give you a good handle on how would I defend on a Linux box, or what are some of the things I should think about that people might try to attack? I think there's just a lot to learn from just kind of studying this, because they, like I said, they pull out a lot of really good details. And obviously this attack took advantage of a lot of different built-in things and some like newer technologies, like the leverage of like the Docker as an example. And then there's some interesting use of other things as well. But those are the things that really stood out to me. I feel like I would have to stare at this longer than I have to be able to pull out even any more specifics. But I think it's definitely for people that aren't familiar with Linux or really want to learn Linux to the point of being able to confidently say they understand how this attack happened, then they have a good understanding of how to defend against a lot of things. So yeah, it's a really cool find.
Yeah, and with, you know, a lot of the architecture, I think, well, it seems like there's, you know, some of the, like they talk about the Jenkins automation server, like a lot of the cloud aspects are going to have a Linux footprint. And we know, because we've discussed it, that, you know, more and more Linux attacks are occurring than you would historically see. So there's a good point about the symlinks and the hidden files. So one thing, though, is kind of a sort of challenge. The temp directory for Linux tends to be, so with Linux, those hidden files are constantly leveraged by programs, usually by programs that will do various things. They'll drop hidden files and delete them. It's a way to kind of like allow the program to do its thing in the background. The temp file, the slash TMP directory is used pretty regularly for that. So it was interesting to see that they did that, because it really would, like, let's say you were tracking all of it, it really would find a way to hide itself in normal activity, because that, depending on the system and how often things are being deployed to it, or how often programs are managing themselves in that way, but they will typically use that directory. The drop hidden files, usually instantaneously remove them, is just a way to kind of pivot or update or do its thing.
And if I remember correctly, and now I'm kind of like going back on the stuff I learned when I was studying different things, like through SANS and stuff when I was getting my master's there. If I remember correctly, one of the unique things about the temp directory on Linux and why programs leverage that, it's a way for programs to also share data with each other or different components too, because if you write something to temp, you own it. So you can't, no one else can delete the things that you create there. Obviously, if you're root, I think you can delete everything, right? But like, if you're like another like service level user or whatever, but you can read everything. So I think it's also a way for programs to exchange and data and monitor different things by using the temp directory in that capacity. Which is also interesting as well. When you look at normal behavior and things being created in temp, I think that's kind of why things are designed that way for that reason. So,
yeah, I wonder, and I don't know this. I'm thinking completely off the throw the spaghetti at the wall side of the house. I wonder if there's ways to kind of track, or if there's variation in what the permissions of given things that are dropped there are, because I imagine with it being used in certain ways, you're probably not going to see a lot of things with those kind of higher level executables being dropped there, because they're really like transitional pieces, right?
Or things that can't execute, I think is very uncommon.
Yeah. And the hidden, like as a hidden piece. So, but that might be something to trace down. I'm interested in looking into that more, but
yeah,
this is a very meaty article. So if you're going to dive into it, grab a cup of coffee.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about some of the things, because of how Linux is designed, and you use the same capabilities and you look at Windows stuff and you start to understand it, is sometimes you can actually develop really cool hunts just based on like how something is designed to work. And so it's really easy to see those outliers. And I feel like with Linux, kind of the stuff we're slowly breaking into as we're unfolding this, we're kind of getting to that. But I think you can do that with all the operating systems. It just takes that level of understanding that a lot of us don't get to, because no one really goes into that when they talk security. They kind of focus on the higher telemetry stuff. So, yeah.
Right. All right, Scott, what's next?
All right, well, I'm going to take a little bit of a breath. It's just kind of like an update on some of the new stuff that's probably been hitting people have been paying attention to. So it's just a Bleeping Computer article, but it's titled American Airlines Subsidiary Envoy Confirms the Oracle Data Theft Attack. So I'm sure if people have been paying attention, or, you know, they have management above them, they are probably aware of the CLOP campaign that was basically exploiting zero-day vulnerabilities, which included the CVE-2025-61882, which is the Oracle's e-business suite, to enable them to steal data from dozens of organizations. And it was starting, you know, early August, they believe, this year, 2025. And basically, it has been confirmed that one of the claims that CLOP had about, you know, who they attacked and who suffered the data breach, Envoy Air was included in that. So they touched on that, and I don't bring it up because I'm trying to harp on them, but I bring it up because this is a big vulnerability that, you know, especially when someone says zero day, like, how do you prepare for that, right? And then you become this whole cycle on, oh my gosh, do we have things that are, one, publicly exposed? Is it this specific thing? Have we been hit, and how do we patch it? Like, that's typically the process that people go through when stuff like this hits. And just like a lot of these kind of web application components that get hit by these types of attacks or zero days, we see the common very common behavior. It took a while to see some real data come out, to see some of the post-compromise activity. But just like most things, you know, one nice thing is Oracle, right? They created our own Java, right? And so that's kind of when they have a web front end, it uses Java primarily for a lot of their stuff. Well, in this case, just like we've looked at other types of like web shells or web server compromises, they're able to basically, when they execute things, it's using that suite that's running Java to basically kick off system level processes. And so I've talked about this before with other web shells and other like web server compromises, really looking for those server processes kicking off system level binaries, either on Windows, because in this case, I think the examples we've seen where they're using the command prompt cmd.exe to run things, and on the Linux side of the house, we're seeing bash being run. And so it's just, those are just easy things to be hunting for. You might even be able to build some detections to get that, you know, early alerted kind of activity that kind of gives you that few steps ahead of the 0-day problem that we see with these web server side compromises. And so if people aren't looking for that, then they're going to go through that other routine where I talked about, where you're kind of just like trying to explore the idea that we may have been hit, now we have to confirm and deal with it, versus identifying there's activity. And, you know, what is it they say, you know, if you basically shorten the time frame of a breach, you also save yourself lots of money from all the stats that you've seen. That might give you an advantage there. So there's that. And the other activity that's been seen, which is also really good to look for, is learn about how people do discovery on the different operating systems. Because I'll tell you what, I don't know many attackers that just are confident when they land somewhere and know exactly where they're going to go, what they're going to do. You imagine going into anywhere blind, you're just going to want to make sure you make the right moves. And so there's just almost always discovery-based activity. And if you know what common discovery stuff or important things to discover on those types of systems, depending on, you know, what it is you think the attackers would be interested in, that's a kind of exactly what you'd see here in this case. The only examples we really saw from a reported data perspective was the Linux-based discovery stuff, but it was all stuff you'd expect, like looking at, and like I said before, Linux is host-based, right? So a common thing is catting. If you don't know what cat is, I don't even know what it really stands for in the top of my head, but it's a basic way to output stuff from files. And there's, since Linux is a file-based operating system, you cat all the right files, you're seeing a lot of configurations and a lot of things about a system. So just knowing what those files are in Etsy usually, and other areas that may be of interest based on, you know your environment well enough, hopefully. That's just a good way to see activity you normally wouldn't see, especially if you see like a, you know, extended amount of it. I just really want to kind of call some of those things out, because, you know, this is always in the news. We always see these things. We see the scramble. We hear about it. People ask us about it when this stuff happens. And it's just, the nice thing is we kind of came up with our way of handling these in the past. And when I say past, now we're probably talking years. And so far, it's been consistent with the way we think about these exploits, the way we think about these problems. We don't help you find if you're vulnerable before a vulnerability is discovered, because that's way more work and resources and knowledge than we really have. But we know how to identify when there's a problem. So, I just kind of wanted to harp on that and kind of bring that up. So, what are your thoughts?
I mean, good points. Still on thunder on the discovery thing a little bit. That's looking at, when you see clop, I can go back to times when, like, these were things that I had to chase down in ways that you were saying, right? So 0 days tend to, when they pop, when the threat actors are using them, typically, and my confidence is aligned to, you know, actual reality here, but typically when there's 0 days out there, it takes time for exploits to be developed to leverage them. And if there are zero days that have exploits that are leveraging them, when people do leverage them, those zero days tend to have a kind of a smaller window to live, right? Before they're eventually discovered and patched, et cetera. So groups like Klopp, who generally show a smash and grab kind of mentality, right? They're going to hit environments with these zero days, and they are going to need to know where to go next. So those discovery queries looking at that, or looking at kind of like, I don't know, like the general, you know, look at the type of discovery queries that are typical on that system, or that you see in a typical, you know, in a given routine. And then suddenly that change or that variation is an absolute easy identifier to, you know, if you don't know what you're looking for, if you're like, hey, Klopp exploited X zero day on this kind of system. If it's something you want to go blindly look for, because I know that I have in the past been tasked for these kinds of things, right? It's like, hey, we have the zero day. We have these systems or these variations of these systems. Are we affected by this thing? And as the you know, the defender, the SOC guy, I'm like, usually my first thought is like, I don't know. And but we got to go figure it out. We got to go see what we can see, figure out how to look for these things. And that's definitely stuff that I've used in the past, is like looking for those discovery queries, looking for activity that is non-standard. And that's easy to say, because if you're not profiling a given system, you don't know what's routine and what's not, but you can kind of infer some of the things like variances in use of discovery queries, right? Or discovery commands, you know, extensive leveraging of cat to find those various files, as you mentioned, Scott. But it's pretty cool. Also, you know, in the Bleakman computer article, because I think as defenders, our brains are designed to see patterns and stuff. So I'm looking at the bottom kind of part where they're talking about who is Klopp, and the first thing that popped up, because I, you know, we know who Klopp is, right? We've dealt with them. But then you look at this little trend line, it's like 2020 exploited zero day, hit 100 organizations. 2021 exploited the SolarWinds problem. 2023, another 100 companies from a zero day. 2024, another zero day that was leveraged to extort. And now this. So, you know, look out for Klopp in 2026 if we're reading any patterns here. But yeah, that's a good point, Scott. And it's always challenging to kind of combat that zero day thing, because typically you're told that there's a zero day that exists, but you really don't know how it works. There's typically not a proof of concept right away, and you're left to infer a lot of things. So yeah, think small, think what's my normal system look like? And you should be able to put some meat to an investigation, I think.
Right. All right. What do you got for us now?
All right. On this one, more conversational. The article isn't super technical. It's definitely not as technical as that the last one I did. It's not, and that's no knock, because there's a lot of really cool, interesting thought points here of things that were identified. So this is an article from KOI. It's titled "Glassworm: The First Self-Propagating Worm Using Invisible Code. It's Open VSX Marketplace." So Glassworm is a worm-style supply chain attack targeting VS Code extensions on Open VSX. That uses novel stealth and resilient C2 techniques to self-propagate across developer ecosystems. The campaign weaponizes invisible Unicode characters or variation selectors to embed executable JavaScript that is invisible to human view, and most static scanners can't see it, really undermining that manual code review controls, or so bypassing EDR visibility, things like that. The malware uses a trio of resilient C2 mechanisms. So one that I thought was really interesting, because I don't think I've come across the time when people leverage blockchain for C2, but they're leveraging the Solana blockchain for its C2, leveraging those transactions. They're also using direct payload HTTP endpoints. And then they also have a reserve backup where they have hard-coded C2 set up around a Google Calendar entry. So it's really, they really went pretty in depth to making the takedown of their C2 environment and or remediation pretty difficult, if not impossible, to mitigate. The infected developer workstations would become credential harvesters, or SOX proxy nodes, or HVNC, that's hidden VNC hosts, peers in a peer-to-peer BitTorrent DHT command distribution, enabling that large-scale lateral abuse. And mostly what it seems to be focused on is crypto wallet theft. So the invisible code piece was interesting. The attackers would insert malicious code using Unicode variation selectors and other non-printing characters. So the code appears completely blank in the editors. And if you were to do a diff on it, it wouldn't be detected. But it does execute in JavaScript interpreters. It really defeats that visual review in the diff-based detection, which is I found very interesting. And I have yet, I'm kind of curious what you think about that one, Scott. The other part, that blockchain C2, so Glassworm scans Solana transactions from a hard-coded wallet, and then it reads the memo field, which has a Base64 encoded pointer to the next stage of the payload, and then it fetches that encrypted payload from that indicated URL. Very interesting there. The payloads are AES encrypted. Decryption keys are returned in the HTTP response headers, forcing live fetches to obtain keys and payloads, really complicating the static blocking of it. It also has a piece in its multi-stage capability of a zombie module. So after decryption, there's a zombie rat that enables SOX proxying, WebRTC peer-to-peer control, BitTorrent DHT command distribution, and then that hidden VNC for a stealthy remote desktop, and automated persistence and module updates as well. So the credential harvesting and propagation side, Glassworm steals NPM, GitHub, and OpenVSX tokens. That's one of its main goals, as well as targets 49 different browser wallet extensions to kind of drain or steal that crypto. Then it uses the stolen credentials to push malicious updates, further spreading through the marketplace. So that's the propagating side of the house. The impact is pretty deep, with KOI noting that at least 5 extensions at the time of this article are still distributing this malware. And there seems to be a total impact of around 35,800 installs still actively out in the wild. But yeah, you know, Scott, there wasn't a ton, like, from the technical side of the house. There were some more, you know, inferring or thinking about how to kind of potentially go after looking for some of these things. Though there were a couple low-hanging fruit things, well, really one specifically. In the appendix piece, they talked about some of the persistence mechanisms where we see something that's very common of the edit of the current version run registry key.
Yeah.
That's something that we see constantly. So low hanging fruit there. Other things that I was thinking through, you know, this comes more to the network side of the house, but I wonder what the potential is. And I haven't thought all the way through this. This is something that I kind of like bucketed as an idea to research a little bit later. But they talk about the specific OpenVSX extensions, the malicious versions of them, and how quickly some of these are patched. I don't know that. I would imagine not as fast as certain things that we see that come out that need to be patched. Looking for the download or leveraging of these, or scanning to see if these exist in your environment is an obvious way to go and check on things. They do list out the, I don't know, 10 or 15 or 20 or so of them. There was just kind of two things that I pointed out. The other hard-coded infrastructure stuff or the IPs and things, we already see that these can be easily rotated. The Google Calendar part I thought was interesting, but I haven't really looked into that. So I wonder what you can see when that communication happens. I wonder if you can identify the Base64 piece that's being pulled from there. And then the other side, you know, depending on your environment, although they are targeting crypto stuff, but then again, we have seen over time where people target machines in environments that aren't specifically designed for crypto, and they still look for it, right? It's kind of a spray and pray transactions and things like that are targeting or going like in or out towards the blockchain. You know, it might be an identifier, but haven't dug too deep into that. But anyway, the parts that I thought were very interesting to this, that invisible Unicode, really cool. Leveraging blockchain for C2, also really cool. I mean, and I mean cool in a way that it's just unique and it's very interesting. So I don't know. What did you think, Scott?
Yeah, no, I think it's like one of the more creative malwares. And it's interesting to me because it sounds more criminal and not so operationally focused because of the amount of creativity. Because there's like a lot of potential to do a lot of different things. Versus when I think of like nation state specific or operational focus, it's like capabilities specifically developed for these key purposes to hit intended targets for expected outcome. This just kind of opens you up for a lot of things. And obviously the huge grab for credentials, it's all about making money, but it's like
very open-ended for trying to do that in a way that is somewhat pretty clever. But it's using all those like enthusiast type technologies, right? Like the fact, like the Google Calendar thing, but then the Base64 encoded and the blockchain thing, and then some of the common remote type tooling and you know, SOX proxies and stuff like that. It's like, if I was an enthusiast or a hobbyist and you're like, hey, try to figure this out, this is the kind of solution I could see those types of people coming up with. So that to me is like really interesting. But like you said, there's some dead giveaways. One, if they're going to throw in, it doesn't matter if something's encoded or encrypted, but it gives an IP and you know, where to get a payload, and it's direct call out to an IP on HTTP, hugely questionable. Almost always is. That's the one thing, like everyone was really upset about the whole, like, let's encrypt. Now everything's being encrypted from a security standpoint. And, you know, they're like, well, now we can't see stuff. But it really highlights, because now most things are using HTTPS and have that level of certificate-based encryption and setup. So when you start seeing things that, one, go straight to IPs that aren't using HTTPS, that's just a huge red flag. And like I said, it, to me, also points to that enthusiast, because they're just kind of like doing something quick on the fly that works. And they are thinking that just the Google Calendar thing would help them hide enough of their activity. But if you have visibility to any of that kind of traffic from the website, that's just a huge find. Obviously, the run key you were talking about was big. But the other thing, I think it's very creative using the blockchain theme, because like the persistence of the C too. I get it. But I also feel like there is still a level of anonymity. I hope I'm pronouncing that exactly how it should be, but you know, I feel anonymity. Yeah. Like, I feel like when you use something that's supposed to keep your activity or identity secret a lot, you slowly start to strip away that anonymity, if that makes sense. Because now there's like patterns or behaviors or things that may somehow get stitched to other things based on time or activity. So I feel like it's really cool, because yeah, it's hard to take down that communication. But once you know, or you're able to look at memos, if you know, you have access to the ledger, which is public, and you're able to like just basically scrape memo based stuff, I'm assuming you'll be able to find C2s, what wallets are associated to C2s, what activities associated with those wallets, how often, I mean, like, you know what I mean? So then if with enough time and enough activity, you kind of lose some of that, you might kind of self-incriminate, is where my head's kind of going with some of that. So
yeah, but I think the beauty though for the blockchain C2 side, and when I say beauty, I mean that, and I mean, I don't mean that in the glorifying it way. But the side there is that there's really no way to take it down. So even if you identified a wallet as a C2, you can't do anything about it. It lives. It's there.
Sort of.
You can't block it really either in most cases.
But what if you, I don't do enough with blockchain or any of that kind of stuff. But my thoughts are the wallet is owned by a person, right? And so they're the only ones that can control transactions on that wallet. I guess someone can pay to the wallet, right? If they have it that way. But like, I don't know how you attach a memo to that wallet per se, right? I don't know how that transaction is going, but if you do enough activity where someone's able to identify who potentially owns that wallet to a person, and you take that person down, don't you kind of effectively take down the C2?
So in theory, the caveat though, I think, is that, you know, tracing to the given wallet is one thing. But expecting it in the general sense, at least from my experience and what I understand, once you start, you know, attackers aren't going to just hop to a wallet and be completely identifiable. It's going to multi-stage hop, and it's eventually going to find its way to a blockchain. It's untraceable, like a Monero, right? In typical sense, because it is easy, because at some point you're going to want to withdraw or leverage that to get actual currency. Yeah, at some
like,
point.
If you're not lazy, I feel like you can put enough layers to extend that time, and hopefully that time is longer than your life expectancy or the term of which you're going to do whatever that's wrongdoing, right? But I feel
it's literally effortless to spin up a new wallet, right? And then you run into the same piece where then you're going to have to start to retrace again.
Yeah, you'll have to figure out how to get everything reconnected to the new wallet and stuff like that. So like, there's components to that that make it sound like it's really cool, but I also feel like it could be one of the biggest vulnerabilities of this thing as well.
If you're not smart, it definitely leads you to you're exposing yourself. You're dead right on there.
So that's kind of how I was thinking about that. But I think what's really cool about this is they're leveraging a lot of technologies that we as security professionals should definitely understand. And if anything, if you have a lab, these are all worth playing with to see how they even work for just even like simple remote access to some capability, right? To like, if you wanted to manage some things and have some fun, whatever. Like, I think there's some cool things there that it's worth paying attention to a lot of these different components that this attack utilizes.
Yeah, spot on, man. Spot on. We got to know about this. Obviously, they're using it as C2. Like, there's a demonstrated article. We constantly see things targeting crypto theft, right, from the criminal side. So, yeah, we need to know about this stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, all pretty cool.
All right, what's last for this week, Scott?
Yeah, so I'm gonna dig into something that it has some meat to it, but you know, also there's some high level components. But it's a Talos intelligence report or blog. It's titled "Beaver Tail and Otter Cookie Evolve with a New JavaScript Module." Basically, the Talos they follow. I think they call them Famous Kolima, if I'm saying that correctly. I hate how I don't know if I say things correctly anymore. But basically, it's a group that's aligned or affiliated with North Korea, or DPRK, sometimes how they're referenced. It's known for impersonating and hiring organizations to target job seekers, tricking them to basically install info stealers or types of malware to obtain, you know, user credentials and cryptocurrency. And just to touch on the credential thing, because the last one was on credentials, and I didn't bring it up. I've recently been looking at insurance-based threat reporting, and I think that's really fascinating because we always do our quarterly or end of the year reporting off of like big breach companies. But I also feel like breach companies are not leveraged. You know, they don't cover the full footprint very well. And maybe there's some things they don't disclose because of some terms or agreements or things that they have with that. The insurance company thing I thought was really interesting because more and more people have to have cyber insurance, and they did all their data based on claims. And the one big thing they saw there was that credentials, when it came to claims and breaches, overtook malware dramatically. So when you start looking at all these attacks, like this one I'm talking about here, or capabilities and one previously, credentials are just like the new next best thing. Because that's what's leading to a lot more compromises. And I have my theories there too. But either way, just wanted to throw that out there before I forget. But yeah, look at for quarterly reports and things from insurance and firms that do cyber insurance. You'll find some really good data. But now let me digress back to this. So basically, the incident they're looking at, it was not directly targeted, but one of its systems was compromised, likely because the user was deceived by that typical fake job offer. And they are installing a Trojanized Node.js application, and it was called ChessFi or whatever. The interesting thing with the Node.js is it makes it much easier because some of the previous versions of this malware were Python based, and with Node.js, with that whole JavaScript component, makes it easier to attack multiple OSs with less opposition, right? You don't need to make sure Python's there or the right stuff is there for the Python environment, all that kind of good stuff. So, but they basically, this group, Famous Kolima, they often use two malicious tools, Beaver Tail and Otter Cookie. But they're starting to notice that there's some overlap now starting to happen with some of the functions. And what was really interesting with their analysis, which I thought was really cool, they were looking at some of the code base, and obviously there were some obfuscations, especially when it came to function names and things. And I thought it was a clever way to use an LLM when they had the code, especially with obfuscation, is they had the LLM look at the code and rename the functions to more better represent the purpose of the function, which then made it much easier to digest
the code, because you can just like read it more like a book from like, this function does this and it's making these calls to these functions to do these things. I thought it was an interesting, quick and dirty way. If you ever get your hands on obfuscated code or code in general that you're really curious about, to kind of have that capability. So that's something they did here. It also helped them understand the kind of the merging of some of the logic, at least capabilities, right, amongst these things. So that was also really, really cool as well. They kind of talked through a lot of different kind of the versions of like, they had like a good breakout where it showed like the different things that were added version to version, which I'll step through a little bit of that. But some things to, you know, notice as well. In this case, we talked about the direct IP call out to kind of hard-coded HTTP requests happening here as well. And now we're talking about something that we would say is more nation state driven. It's tied to North Korea versus the previous one was more, I would say, enthusiast criminal based. They, you know, obviously both use it. There's a, and then the other component as well was the creations of single character file names. Now, in this case, this was associated with some of screenshots and so forth. So very temporary when it comes to files. So you're looking at .tmps or .jpeg, but still named one dot whatever, two dot whatever. I think just knowing those things are being created, it's just kind of good. And the file type might be even more telling of the activity. Like if I did see a bunch of image-based things that are being named, it could be just a really, really lazy administrator or interesting task someone's doing, and they're just trying to create a bunch or capture a bunch of things. Or it could be someone effectively taking screenshots or some malware that's basically doing screen grabbing. So that was interesting. The other thing to notice to note about the HTTP was the port was non-traditional. It was a 1478 TCP port, which is, there's a lot of IDSs. That's a kind of a built-in signature rule for intrusion detection systems of communication to HTTP on non-standard ports. Sometimes those are what we're looking at. They can be really noisy. You got to kind of tune them a little bit sometimes in different ways, but obviously worth looking at. So one of the other things, and this is kind of more of the latest call or latest capability, was the clipboard grabbing. And I thought this was interesting because basically there are two calls they're making there. One was the PowerShell, using PowerShell to use the commandlet get clipboard, which obviously if this is a Node.js or, you know, even Python based malware, the fact you're going to have those things calling PowerShell, and I'm assuming it's also going to be driven in the command line too, if it's just doing a quick grab and frequently just looking for that get clipboard in your command line, might highlight this constant trying to grab because it was doing it very frequently. The other thing is on macOS, which I'm not as familiar with how this command or if it's a binary or what it works, but it's PB paste, all kind of one word. That's apparently, if you see that for repeated use, that's another thing they were using to basically grab the clipboard for stealing anything that you've copied. And one other recommendation, which I thought was an interesting one, which you have to have the right tooling to help with this telemetry as well, but they were saying hunting for processes that were searching across, you know, and they have a whole list of all their search words. Which could be pneumatic, wallet, C, docx, JSON, like files that someone would be interested in. But it really came down to, what about looking for numbers of large amounts of file reads? So sometimes we do see file reads, and that can be incredibly noisy. So a lot of people don't log that. But if you happen to have file reads, especially in certain circumstances, like maybe if you can control your logging, you can set up file reads to say like non-standard locations, like files from there that maybe you're executing and then doing a lot of file reads. You might be able to find something else where it's looking for data, right? Potentially steal just by touching a bunch of files. I mean, ransomware, that was like a big, I mean, ransomware came out. That was a big thing to say, well, how do we know if ransomware? It's like, well, if you have one process that's touching like everything on the drive,
it's like highly questionable and concerning in some instances. So that was something else to note. But they did talk about some of, like, I talked about the modules over the time. So, you know, they did like the V1 through V5, because they're saying they're kind of more along V5. And, you know, September to November 2024, V1 was really just their remote command shell downloader from basically attacker controlled infrastructure. And it was really meant to steal browser profiles, files associated with that. And then V2 kind of came from, you know, late November 2024 into February 25. And that was where the clipboard stealer was adding using of the clipboardy NPM package. And then V3 is when they did the file stealer in the main source code, where it traversed all mounted disk drives and file folder names with the inclusions and exclusions. So that was February to April 2025. And then April, the clipboard stealing using standard OS commands, which I mentioned with the Mac, the PB paste, and then the PowerShell git clipboard. And then adding the VM environment checking as part of that remote command shell. So it's checking for, you know, VMs essentially. And then April to August of 2025, just recently, that's when they did the addition of the keylogger and screenshotting module, and the clipboard stealing included into the module. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting to see, one, you're starting to see kind of the merging of capabilities across the two main tool sets they use. So development, it looks like they're kind of working close together with internal teams or whatever they're trying to accomplish. But also the time frame is pretty quick for adding capabilities. And obviously if you're adding capabilities and you're kind of using the same baseline of your malware that's common enough and it's still not being detected, it just shows why it's important to be looking for behaviors in a lot of instances. Because if you've been using the same malware for over a year and just adding capabilities to it and you're still having success, it shows that behaviors might tend to function a little bit better. I think those were the big things I wanted to call out. They kind of talk about some infection pass stuff, but I'll give you, I guess, some air to see what you saw or what you think.
A couple things, because I was going to talk about that clipboard piece. There are some interesting things that I don't know if people are aware, but like between Windows and Mac, so that PB paste basically allows a copy command to be put in a terminal, because by default, you can't do a command V and then with terminal to paste, you need like an ability to do that. So that allows the copied command, the command steal from the clipboard, to be dropped into a terminal session. But something that people may or may not know, there are some differences when it comes to the Mac and Windows environments relative to the clipboard. Currently Mac only allows like one thing in the clipboard at a time, whereas Windows you can have up to 25, the most recent 25 stored. You can actually see that in Windows if you do, I think it's a Windows key plus V. But I'll actually pull up your clipboard where you can see all the clipboards. You can actually quickly access them. I'm going to guess here, but it's been around for at least 6-7 years.
Okay. Because I know it's a while. Primarily in registry too. So like there are registry keys that I think store your clipboard stuff. And that's another thing to potentially look for. They're not using it here, but you know, you got to think outside the box of how can this be leveraged in general, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's just, you know, Windows has always has a relatively larger attack surface, but definitely things to note. The other part that I kind of scanned out of this is when I see articles that talk about where they're deploying payloads, leveraging like Git clone, or like in this case, I think they were doing a Git clone from Bitbucket. I'd imagine, you know, in most environments,
not normal.
It shouldn't be normal, right? Like there should be very specific roles or people that are leveraging just the Git clone commands in general, right? And maybe in some environments they're leveraging a repo to deploy software in specific ways. So it might be, you know, there might be some normalized pattern there, but by and large, seeing that should be a relative indicator for like an analyst side of the house to consider, is this normal? Is this not? At a bare minimum, ask that question, right? Because it shouldn't be overwhelmingly noisy. And I wouldn't think in most environments. So those are just a couple of things that I kind of pulled out of this one, Scott.
Yeah, a lot of good points. Another one, like it's there's probably some things that I didn't hit on. So there's kind of a good read. There's some good information when you talk about, like, if you want to explain threats to somebody and how they evolve over time and what does that look like, this is another good reference for that too. Just because I think some people, especially if you don't work in the space, getting to think about why we do what we do and why we need to be rigorous or stay up to date or have the right resources matter. It's kind of a good example of that. I think that closes out most of the things we want to say. Just a quick reminder, we do have the Threat Hunting Management Workshop where I'll be talking about the business value of threat hunting. Kind of trying to steer into what can you do from a threat hunting perspective to help with those communications, to get more support or potentially budget to either build out their hunting program, expand it, or get the business to really understand why you do it and how it could potentially be slightly different from just basic security all the time. And we also, and that'll be October 29th, coming up from 12 to 12:30 Eastern Standard Time. So this should be a quick conversation, but hopefully some insights that will be helpful. And we have our live edition coming up in November of the podcast. We're doing another Guess Who edition, where basically we try to talk about a threat actor and some of the things that they have done and their capabilities. So it's a good way to learn about a lot of different capabilities, and hopefully someone will be able to guess who the threat actor is, which we do a reveal at the end. And that's a longer episode, it's our live one, but we have a lot to talk about. We usually do with those. So that'll be November 19th. It's on a Wednesday. We usually do them on Thursday, but it's Wednesday this time, just for better convenience for more people. And that'll be 12 to 1:30 Eastern Standard Time. So definitely pay attention to those. I'll try to invite people that I know that are connected to me and so forth. But I really want to thank everyone for joining this Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast episode. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out the top threat hunting headlines for the week of October 20th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.